Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Friday, the 29th of March, these are our main stories. The former cryptocurrency billionaire Sam Bankman-Fried has been sentenced to 25 years in jail for one of the biggest financial frauds in US history. The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to take urgent action to ensure basic food supplies to Palestinians in Gaza, saying starvation is spreading. Doctors have reported a sharp increase in cases of dengue fever in the Americas, which could be linked to global warming. Also in this podcast,
the bill states that it's against the law to discriminate on the basis of the cut, length, colour or texture of a person's hair.
The French lower house of parliament begins the legal process to protect against such prejudicial practices in the workplace. Wherever the wunderkind Sam Bankman-Fried goes, the circus follows. Thursday was no exception. As the world's media gathered outside a court in Manhattan in New York, the former crypto king arrived with his trademark bushy black hair, but wearing prison clothes supplied by a detention centre. He's been held there since August last year when a judge revoked his bail because of what he called likely tampering with witnesses. But with a sentence of 25 years for stealing $8 billion from the customers of the now bankrupt FTX cryptocurrency exchange, it may be Sam Bankman-Fried's last appearance in public for some time. His parents, who are both professors of law, were outside court doing their best not to talk to journalists.
Respect us and let us walk away.
Did you ever think this would happen to your son? You're an attorney.
What is your legal advice as an attorney? Pardon? Here, what you would do?
How are you feeling today?
How are you feeling today?
No answer to that or any of the other questions. I spoke to our New York business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, and asked her for more about the sentence that was handed out.
The prosecutors had been asking for as much as 40 to 50 years, and sentencing guidelines were such that it could have been as much as 110 years. I think what the judge, Lewis Kaplan, was taking into account here was three factors. One, his age, he's 32. Secondly, the losses involved. And thirdly, the idea of deterrence. What message are you sending to stop others from committing similar crimes going forward? And speaking to lawyers who specialise and focus on white-collar crime, speaking to former prosecutors, speaking even to one of the lead prosecutors who brought the case against the disgraced financier Bernie Madoff, there is a sort of sense that he kind of hit the right balance between these three things. The idea is that if he serves the full sentence of 25 years, he will emerge as a 50-something-year-old. And the idea that this kind of wunderkind, who the judge said seemed to express little remorse, the chances are that by his 50s, he sort of won't be perhaps so persuasive or may have changed by then.
Yeah, you mentioned that Sam Bankman-Fried didn't have much remorse. He did apologise to his victims. Was that enough for the judge?
Well, and he also said that he thought the most useful part of his life was over. And he said that he had made bad decisions. There was also Mark McCasey, who's the defence attorney for Bankman-Fried. He tried to sort of paint him as a sensitive, good-hearted person, as something of an awkward math nerd. But here's the thing, none of that seemed to hold sway with the judge, who basically took into account what Mr. Bankman-Fried was saying, took into account his autism, the fact that he's socially awkward, but he still said that he committed a very serious crime. And he kept going back again and again to testimony from Caroline Ellison. Now, she was the head of Alameda Research, the hedge fund where some of the money was taken from the FTX crypto trading platform and kind of siphoned off into the hedge fund. She was also the former girlfriend of Mr. Bankman-Fried. And it was her testimony, it seems in hindsight, that kind of held sway with the judge, who kind of said that based on that, he felt Mr. Bankman-Fried was evasive, that he was splitting hairs while lying about his conduct. And so here we are, this 25-year sentence. Not to forget also, he's got to forfeit $11 billion, and that's to compensate victims. I think the judge was trying to say, you know, this should not happen again.
Michel Fleury in New York. Just before the sentence was handed out, Sam Fenwick spoke to Samuel Haypack, CEO of Wincent, a company on the crypto exchange FTX.
We just had our money on the exchange. We lost $35 million.
35 million?
Yes.
Wow, that's a lot to lose.
That's a lot to lose.
How do you feel about what's being played out in court now?
Well, I think it's very important for the future to reduce the amount of fraud that's happening around crypto. And I believe that the way to do that is to show that fraudsters are going to be punished.
You were a customer, as you say, investing other people's cash. Tell us the moment that you had to tell them, your customers, that you'd lost this $35 million.
It was a very, very bad moment. We did a conference call with all of our investors. There were 200 of them. And we had to explain to them that we lost $35 million of their money, which was a substantial percentage of what every one of them invested. Now, naturally, they were upset, they were angry, they considered us utterly incompetent, that we were able to trust such a fraudster, that we didn't see this coming sooner, etc. As a result of that, we lost 25% of those investors. They decided they don't trust us anymore, they don't trust our judgment anymore. They took the remaining money that they had with us away, and essentially, this led to us losing half of our capital at all.
So whilst you've lost $35 million in the FTX situation, you've actually lost a lot more.
Yes, we lost double that, essentially.
Samuel Haypack. Israel has been ordered to allow urgent humanitarian assistance in Gaza by judges at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. The court said famine and starvation are spreading and Israel must take effective action to ensure basic food supplies arrive without delay for the Palestinian population in Gaza. The measures were requested by South Africa as part of its case that accuses Israel of state-led genocide in Gaza. The United Nations has warned that the health system in Gaza is collapsing. It's also said its warnings about famine in the north are ever closer to becoming a reality and water is becoming increasingly scarce. James Elder from the UN children's charity UNICEF said people in Gaza were living in fear for their lives.
They are so exhausted by this nightmare that they have said that they want it to be over and they want to be hit by a bomb. And the horrendous reality is that you hear things here all the time that you shouldn't normally hear, whether it's that or whether it's talking to a child who's lost their entire family. And yes, when the bombardments are intense, as they often are, when you lie in bed because there's no protection, so you lie there just waiting. And it does feel like a coffin. And you think of those children who've done that every single night for 5.5 months.
Our correspondent, Hugo Bechega, is following developments from Jerusalem.
I think this shows that patience is running very low, international patience with Israel, given the humanitarian situation in Gaza and this decision by the ICJ now urging Israel to take all the necessary measures to ensure the basic supplies arrive without delay to the Palestinian population in Gaza. What we're seeing here is that aid organizations are accusing Israel of deliberately creating obstacles to the delivery of aid, something that the Israelis have denied. They say that The problem is with the distribution of aid inside Gaza. They are blaming the United Nations. They are blaming, you know, charities inside Gaza, something that all these groups have rejected. So I think pressure is growing on Israel. And I think this decision again shows, you know, how the international community is, you know, exasperated by the situation in Gaza.
It was quite striking, I think, watching the head of UNICEF saying that people in Gaza are, you know, they think that people outside don't know that they're so hungry, that they're starving.
Just days ago, I was in Rafah on the Egyptian side of the Gaza border, and UN officials told me that 1,500 trucks are waiting to cross the border, to be allowed by Israeli authorities to cross the border. So you have this situation that there is, you know, the aid waiting to, you know, be allowed into Gaza, and just kilometers away on the other side of the border, people, you know, going hungry, some people dying because of hunger, and obviously, you know, concerns that famine may happen, especially in the north of the territory, if the situation doesn't change.
Meanwhile, there's an intensification of fighting around the hospital in Khan Yunis.
Exactly, and the Israeli military says it has killed dozens of Hamas fighters near Al-Amal Hospital, which has now been evacuated, and Israeli troops are also near the Nasser Hospital in the city. So this is where Palestinians have been seeking shelter, and the Palestinian Red Crescent has raised concerns about thousands of people, it says, are stuck in the hospital. And the United Nations again has warned that across Gaza, the health system is collapsing because of the fighting, and with shortages of basic supplies, many Palestinians are unlikely to survive.
Hugo Beshega in Jerusalem. The United States and South Korea have reacted with fury to Russia's decision to use its Security Council veto to block the renewal of an expert panel that monitors the enforcement of sanctions against North Korea. A U.S. State Department spokesman accused Moscow of undermining international peace and security to advance the corrupt bargain it had struck with Pyongyang. And the South Korean ambassador to the U.N., Hwang Joon-kook, had this to say.
Russia employed an all too familiar and obvious tactic by insisting on completely unacceptable conditions without any room for compromise. This is almost comparable to destroying a CCTV to avoid being caught red-handed.
Our United Nations correspondent Neda Taufik has more details.
Until now, the Security Council had voted annually over 14 years to renew the panel of experts. They have monitored and investigated sanctions violations and have reported back to the Council with recommendations. Russia's UN ambassador, Vasilina Benzia, said that the panel played into the hands of the West, whose countries led by the U.S. were trying to strangle North Korea. In a joint statement after the vote, the U.S., Britain, France, Japan, and South Korea said Russia's veto was nothing more than an attempt to silence independent, objective investigations into persistent violations of the sanctions by North Korea and Russia itself. The countries accused Moscow of trying to block the panel's investigation into Russia's alleged violations of the sanctions. It's believed to have secured arms from Pyongyang for its war in Ukraine.
Neda Taufik in New York. Next to India, the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has been in power for two terms. During that time, the country has experienced religious polarization and widespread Islamophobia. Ahead of the general election due to begin next month, which Mr. Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party is expected to win, people from the Muslim community, who make up India's largest minority, have told the BBC they feel they're being marginalized and suppressed. The government denies the allegations. Yogita Lamai reports from northern India.
I'm at the Jaipur Junction. It's a bustling, busy railway station in the northwest of India. On the 30th of July, a train began its journey from here en route to Mumbai. But before it reached its destination, a railway police constable shot dead four people. One of them was his colleague, but three others were Muslim civilians. In a country where we are seeing increasing violence against the Muslim minority, this is an incident that stands out, because the person who carried out the violence took a pledge to protect all civilians of India.
A chilling mobile phone video of the incident surfaced on social media, showing the railway policeman standing with his foot on the bloodied body of one of his victims. Your masters are in Pakistan, we know. But if you want to live in India, vote for Prime Minister Modi, he's heard saying. The railway policeman is being tried for murder, but the incident has led to fear within their community, the victim's wife, Umesa Begum, says.
I believe my husband was killed because he had a beard and wore a skull cap and was visibly a Muslim. And the man who killed him wasn't an ordinary man. He was a railway policeman. How can we trust the police now? I want to tell the Prime Minister this is all because of your politics. That's why such incidents are increasing. When my children go out, I worry about whether they'll come back safely or not.
The Minister for Minority Affairs didn't reply to the BBC's questions about the issue, but I'm now meeting Syed Zafar Islam, a Muslim spokesman from the Prime Minister's party, to ask him about the allegations of rising Islamophobia under Mr. Modi's government.
It is the opposition parties who are using Muslim community as a shield. They are feeling the hate. Muslim community is absolutely comfortable. They are happy.
But sir, people have told us this. We have recorded this. Ordinary people, not political parties.
If one or two people say such thing, it cannot be true for the entire community.
We've come to a Muslim-dominated locality in Delhi to hear what ordinary people think.
Now, the major problem is insecurity in the community, right? This is something which is very painful. My close friend who used to visit my home, and nowadays he is not coming because he gets to know that he is a Muslim and he should not be going there.
The way experience of being a Muslim in India has changed is there is a very major sense of insecurity here. For example, if you take your mic and you walk around here, there won't be many people who would be looking to talk to you. They don't want their name or face coming up on TV and being targeted for whatever reason.
And indeed, it was extremely hard to get people to talk to us. A lot of people didn't want to be recorded out of fear of reprisal. And that's something that's really new for me. In nearly 20 years of being a journalist in India, I can't ever remember coming to a Muslim locality and seeing this kind of fear and apprehension on the ground. The extent of religious polarization deeper than I've ever experienced before.
Yogita Lamai. Still to come.
I'm a perfect example of a non-stereotypical lifeguard. I'm now 74, so I can't imagine any of the lifeguards on Baywatch being more than 20-somethings.
A man in southern England has entered the record books for being the longest-serving lifeguard.
What stories and advice would you like to share with daughters everywhere?
And what are different countries around the world getting right in order for women to live well and succeed?
Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives and what the rest of the world could learn from them.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new season. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. UN health officials say the number of cases of dengue fever across the Americas has trebled in the first 3 months of the year compared to the same period in 2023. Our Americas regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
The Pan-American Health Organization, a UN agency that represents 35 countries, says that more than 3.5 million cases of dengue have been reported in the region. Over 1,000 people have died. The worst affected countries are Brazil, Argentina, and Peru, which last month declared a national health emergency. Most cases of the mosquito-borne disease are mild, but it can cause debilitating muscle and joint pain and high temperature, which often require hospital treatment. Health experts say climate change and the El Niño phenomenon have created the ideal conditions for the spread of the dengue-transmitting mosquito.
Leonardo Rocha. You might think you know all about the effects of global warming, but what about this one? It's making the Earth rotate more slowly. So much so that the next leap second, the extra second that gets added to reconcile clock time to the actual movement of the Earth, may well get added 3 years later than was previously expected. It's because water, which has melted from the polar ice caps, moves towards the equator. Johnny Diamond spoke to the director of the Centre for Polar Observation and Modelling, Andrew Shepherd. So could time really be affected by the movement of water?
Yeah, it is. So this water was previously on top of the Greenland ice sheet or the Antarctic ice sheet. And when it melts, it goes into the oceans. And we know about that because it causes sea levels to rise. But there's also a more subtle effect. And it means that the mass moves towards the equator and spread evenly around the planet. And that actually causes the planet to slow down in the same way that a ballerina spinning would slow down if they move their arms outwards.
I mean, I know that those who have to bring the leap second in are actually fairly relieved about it because it plays havoc with everybody's calculations and clocks. But this is more significant than a leap second here or there. This is another sort of message from the Earth that things are changing.
Yeah, I mean, it's another bad news story, unfortunately, but it's a good example of how climate change affects all kinds of different parts of our lives. You might not think it's important that the Earth is slowing down, but that changes all of the satellite telecommunications that we rely on, and people have to take account of that to make sure that the GPS system is as precise as we want it to be. And all of that has to go on in the background because, of course, we don't program those satellites, but everyone else has to.
And are you surprised by this finding?
So it's quite interesting that the fingerprint of climate change crops up in all kinds of different records. I was quite surprised to see that geodesists, people who look at the Earth and time, have spotted it. And they, I guess they were saying, what's going on here? Something must be happening. And they're not climate scientists, so they had to hunt around for the source of this and then stumbled upon the fact that our polar ice sheets are melting at a colossal rate, and so they have to join the dots.
Andrew Shepherd from the Centre for Polar Observation and Modelling. Unprofessional, dirty and wild. Those were the words used to describe Kenza's Afro-style hair when she was looking for a job at the age of 17. The online campaigner is one of many people in France who say they've been discriminated against because of their hair. But on Thursday, a new bill was approved by the French lower house of parliament that would forbid this sort of discrimination. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield told me more.
What the man behind this law is saying is that it may sound frivolous, it may sound not very serious, it may sound a bit of a joke, but it's not, because he's saying that there is a reality under which people are being discriminated against because of their hair. The bill's being drafted so that it's not specific to any gender or any race, and he says red-headed people are discriminated against sometimes and blonde people are discriminated against sometimes. You know, the old cliches about blonde people are stupid and all this sort of stuff. Even bald people, he says, are. So they're included in this. But I mean, it's quite clear that the main reason for this law is black people, the pressure that some of them have felt historically and still today to straighten their hair, to redesign their hair, to make it more acceptable to norms that prevail in Western societies and so on. I mean, for example, there was the famous case of a man, black man, who was a flight attendant on Air France, and there was a big row about his hair, which ended with Air France being taken to court.
So is this bill on the idea of banning discrimination against hair a big talking point in France?
It would be wrong to claim that this is grabbing the attention of the country. It's not. For a start, this is just the lower house of parliament. It's got to go to the upper house of parliament, and there's no guarantee it'll pass through the upper house. It's a sort of law that I think people will find it very hard to say no to, because, of course, everyone agrees in principle with the idea that it's wrong to discriminate on any grounds.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. You would expect one of the world's most prestigious universities to have some peculiar items in its collections. But Harvard University in the United States has removed a book from one of its libraries because of its binding made of, wait for it, human skin. Ella Bicknell reports.
Harvard University boasts 20 million books in its collection, but one has a particularly macabre fascination. The 19th century work De Destini de l'âme, which means Destinies of the Soul, is a dark meditation on life after death. The author, Ansin Hussey, gifted a copy to his friend Ludovic Bouland, a psychiatrist who bound the book with the skin of a patient who died in his care, a woman we don't know the name of. Harvard's had it in its collection for 90 years, but it was in 2014 when scientists confirmed human DNA in the binding. The way the university publicised the news was heavily criticised at the time. Rare book collectors called for it to be removed on ethical grounds, launching an open letter in the student newspaper, the Harvard Crimson. Madeline Proctor is one of their staff editors.
Yeah, so it's my understanding that there's sort of been a lore on campus about potentially disrespectful treatment of it being a hazing and ritual for new members of the library or something like that. 2014 when it was tested. That time, Harvard Library announced the fact that it was indeed human skin in two separate blog posts. The dark and joking nature of those blog posts is something that, you know, now the Harvard Library apologizes for.
After 10 years of controversy, Harvard has now removed the binding of the book, saying it had not lived up to ethical standards of care. It added it was looking for ways to ensure the remains will be treated respectfully to restore dignity of the anonymous patient. Harvard's not the only university agonising over how to deal with historic collections featuring human material. But few problems are quite as gruesome as this one.
Ella Bicknell. The beach at Bournemouth in southern England may not have the sunny glamour of Malibu, but try telling that to 74-year-old Chris Lewis. He's just dived into the book of Guinness World Records as the longest-serving lifeguard. Chris's career began in the English coastal resort 58 years ago as a 16-year-old volunteer for the local lifeguard corps, and he's still patrolling the beach for the RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institute. He told James Kumarasamy more.
It's something that I really enjoy doing, so I just have such a good time as a lifeguard, you know, helping other people on the beach. I mean, my two favourite activities.
It's a serious business, of course, though, isn't it? You are the person responsible for saving lives. Tell us what are the memorable moments of your life-saving career?
About 10 years ago now, I had one incident that was particularly memorable. I was patrolling, and we've got wooden groins that go out in the sea to trap sand. And when you've got the wind from the southeast and the tide going out, you can have quite a strong current. So on this particular day, I look down and I see a group of people gradually drifting into that sort of dodgy area. So I run off down the beach. Just as I get there, this one girl who was 16 years of age gets picked up by a wave and slapped right into the end of the groin. And there was quite a lot of blood all over the place. But she also had her brother, who was hanging on to the groin sticking out into the water, which is covered in barnacles. It's lots of little cuts all over him. And then a third little boy who was swimming 10 metres out. So I went, rescued the three of them. As I was walking out, to my amazement, the whole beach stood up and applauded. That's the most outstanding thing, not because of what I did, but the response of the people on the beach.
And what about equipment? I think you started off with a rowing boat.
In the 70s, I worked as a boatman and you were safety patrol. They gave you one rowing boat and a rescue buoy. So you used to go out, chuck an anchor out, have a look, see what was going on. The whole of Bournemouth Beach, there was seven lifeguards. In the summer now, we get nine lifeguards very close to Bournemouth Pier, never mind the whole beach.
Now, I'm going to ask you about Baywatch and glamour. When Baywatch was at its height, the life of a lifeguard seemed to people watching television to be an extremely glamorous one. What's your experience?
My experience of that is that when Baywatch came along, although, yes, there was a little bit of glamour in it, most people tend to think of it as a bit of a joke and didn't take it seriously because of that.
Baywatch wasn't necessarily a good thing for lifeguards.
Well, it promoted some good things, but then the actual individuals that were doing stuff, you know, provided a very stereotypical view of what a lifeguard should look like. And, you know, I'm a perfect example of a non-stereotypical lifeguard. Yeah, I'm now 74, so I can't imagine any of the lifeguards on Baywatch being more than 20-something. So
Would you have swapped Bournemouth for California?
No, Bournemouth's great. I like Bournemouth. It's good.
Chris Lewis, still lifeguarding at the age of 74. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.